Hello, everybody, and thanks for joining us for today's briefing call. I'm Doug Gibson, Chair of Covington's Management Committee. We do understand that some people may be hearing static on the line. We want to let you know that we're working on rectifying that, but we didn't want to delay the start of the call more than 5 minutes. So, again, if you're hearing static, hopefully that'll get cleared up as we're early in the conversation today. I do want to first offer our thoughts and sympathies to those who've been impacted by COVID-19. We've certainly felt these impacts ourselves at Covington, so far principally in our offices in China and Korea, but more recently we've been feeling the impacts in some of our other offices as well. It's obviously a fast-developing situation with new developments daily that we've been closely tracking. Though we can't predict the full impact of the virus, today's briefing is going to cover a core set of considerations that businesses should have top of mind during this difficult time. These core considerations involve a range of different legal disciplines as well as policy considerations. Covington is well positioned to advise on these issues, considering our broad practice mix and expertise at the intersections of law and policy. If you have any questions after today's webinar, please feel free to reach out to us. No question is too small. We often can provide an answer efficiently and with the judgment that flows from our work on similar issues for a range of other clients. So again, thank you very much for participating today. And I now want to turn it over to our first panelists, Nigel Howard and Matt Franker, who will begin by covering the supply chain issues they recommend that businesses consider.
Thanks, Doug. And to add to Doug's suggestion, you can also send email questions to events@cov.com. COVID-19 is causing significant interruptions to international and domestic trade. My comments will focus on whether that disruption qualifies as an event that excuses performance under commercial contracts, and what proactive steps organizations should consider taking. Contracts typically allocate risk associated with events outside of the control of the parties with a force majeure clause. If the contract does not contain a force majeure clause, then statutory law and other legal doctrines may apply. For example, in the United States, the Uniform Commercial Code and the common law defenses of frustration and impossibility may apply. But let's assume the contract in question has an express force majeure provision. Catch-all force majeure provisions are generally construed narrowly, so COVID-19 is more likely to qualify if the provision expressly refers to epidemic, pandemic, state of emergency, or similar terms. In our experience, most force majeure provisions do not include such express examples. COVID-19 may also qualify if the force majeure provision expressly refers to circumstances that have resulted from COVID-19, such as government actions or orders, shortages of supplies, or unavailability of workers, or the inability to travel. An express reference may not be sufficient in itself. In some jurisdictions, a causal link between COVID-19 and the non-performance will be required. In some jurisdictions, you may also require that the force majeure event be the sole cause of the party's alleged inability to perform, applying a but-for test. In most jurisdictions, the event must also have been unforeseeable at the time of contracting, meaning that the interpretation can depend on when the contract was signed and what actions the affected party could have taken to avoid non-performance. For example, consider whether the contract was signed before or after the outbreak became news, and whether the affected party could and should have prepared better. Note that economic burdens, such as inability to pay or performance being more expensive, will not qualify as an event excusing contract performance. In most cases, parties cannot invoke force majeure where the obligations of the contract remain physically and legally possible to perform, albeit less profitably. Obligations to pay are commonly excepted from force majeure provisions. Please note that the analysis will be fact-specific and depend on the jurisdiction of the contract. For example, the obligation to mitigate is strongly emphasized in New York and California courts, but Texas courts tend to be more lenient with respect to obligations to find alternative sources. There is a duty to mitigate under English law, even if the contract includes a force majeure provision, but Singaporean law, by contrast, this duty may or may not apply depending on whether the wording of the provision requires or implies that steps must be taken to avoid the event or impacts of the force majeure. The following are some key topics and practical steps to consider when exercising rights under a force majeure provision because of COVID-19. For supply chain contracts, courts may look into the level of control the affected party had over its component manufacturers. And if there were alternative component manufacturers the affected party could have turned to, particularly if the contract expressly refers to secondary sources of supply. If a manufacturer has contractual rights against a non-performing component supplier, the manufacturer will be expected to enforce those rights. Pay attention to notice provisions in the force majeure clause. Prompt written notice may be a requirement. A party seeking the protection of a force majeure provision must follow all the procedure requirements in the force majeure provision. Consider if other provisions in the contract offer more certainty, such as a termination for convenience right, a change of law, or a material adverse change provision. Examine whether the triggering force majeure clause may have unwanted side effects, such as a right for the other party to terminate. Consider also other commercial provisions, such as representations and warranties, and note that economic burden, market hardship are generally not excuses for non-performance, and thus bank covenants may need specific renegotiation. For contracts currently being negotiated, please consider updating your approach to drafting of the force majeure provisions. And finally, consider establishing a central point of contact within your organization to review the relevant agreements, manage these contract interpretation questions, and to coordinate communications with counterparties. These, as I've illustrated, are fact and jurisdiction-specific questions, and a coordinated approach within your organization is advisable. Finally, I did want to highlight a few points that would be relevant if you're doing work for U.S. government. If the U.S. government imposes additional requirements on you, or you need to incur additional costs, such as purchasing protective gear, that were not contemplated by the contract at the time of formation, you may be entitled to an equitable adjustment. If the U.S. government wants to reduce the scope of a contract or redirect funds, depending on the facts, it may be possible that the reduction could be processed either as a partial termination or for convenience or a deductive change. You may be entitled to compensation for the added or accelerated work. I'll now turn over to my colleague, Matt Franca, who will cover SEC reporting considerations.
Thank you, Nigel. As we've all seen in the news, COVID-19 is causing significant disruptions in the operations of many companies. The virus and efforts to contain its spread are having impacts that are both particularized to the operations of individual companies and industries and also spread broadly across the economy, including significant changes in the economic conditions and, as we all see, significant volatility in both the equity and the bond markets. These issues and their significance vary by company and industry and are changing hourly, if not daily. And they all raise significant disclosure and compliance issues that public companies need to be considering. In my discussion, we're going to talk about two actions that the SEC took last week and then some considerations for public companies as they plan their annual meetings. Last week, the SEC provided conditional reporting relief for companies that are significantly affected by COVID-19, as well as disclosure guidance that they should be considering. With respect to reporting relief, for the period between March 1st and April 30th, public companies and other persons that have SEC filing obligations that are unable to meet a deadline due to circumstances related to COVID-19 may receive an extension of their time to provide disclosure. Any company that's needing to rely on this relief must file a Form 8K or Form 6K for foreign private issuers by the later of March 16th or the original filing deadline, and that filing needs to include disclosure regarding why it is relying on this relief, why it is unable to file on a timely basis, when it expects to be able to file the applicable report, if appropriate, a risk factor explaining the impact of COVID-19 on its business, and if the report cannot be filed in a timely manner due to a third party's inability to furnish an opinion, provide a consent, or a certification, it must provide a signed statement of that person regarding its inability to do so and why it's unable to do so. In addition, the SEC published guidance that really reflects what needs to go into consideration for all reporting companies as they monitor their corporate disclosures and think about their compliance policies. First, if a company has become aware of a risk that's related to COVID-19 that would be material to investors, it should provide appropriate disclosure before the company or the individuals conduct securities transactions, including public offerings, buybacks, or any other transaction that a company may be considering. Appropriate disclosure would be required. In providing disclosures regarding the risks that are related to COVID-19 and its effects, companies should consider whether they are already being affected by COVID-19 and include disclosure to that effect if they are indeed being affected. As with other areas where the SEC has provided guidance in recent years, it is insufficient for a company that is being materially affected by current events to merely say that the risk of the occurrence of effects is a hypothetical. In these circumstances, disclosing the risk alone could be considered a materially misleading statement that could give rise to liability, both to the in an SEC enforcement action, as we've seen last year, as well as potential liability to shareholders. We could also see the staff issue comments in those situations asking companies whether or not they're currently being affected by COVID-19 or any actions to mitigate its effects. Finally, the guidance notes that companies should focus on ensuring that their disclosures regarding COVID-19 and its effects are disseminated widely in a manner that complies with Regulation FD. In addition, companies need to focus on compliance with their insider trading and disclosure policies, including any applicable social media policies. The importance of these policies needs to be emphasized internally at companies in order to avoid inadvertent disclosures, incomplete disclosures, and any other information or communications that are coming from a company or its employees or officials that could affect trading in its stock price or otherwise disrupt the public markets for that company. Finally, in addition to these issues, calendar year companies that are in the process of planning their annual shareholder meetings need to take COVID-19 into consideration. Depending on a number of factors, including the scheduled time for the meeting, historical attendance patterns, and the progression of the disease, companies may wish to consider alternatives to a traditional annual meeting structure, or alternatively, postponing or changing the location of a meeting. If a company wishes to experiment with a virtual annual meeting, either as a complement to an in-person meeting or as a virtual-only meeting, there should be disclosure to that effect, and companies should be working with their service providers to ensure that participants in such a meeting have the ability to meaningfully participate as though they were there in person. That's something that the proxy advisors have emphasized repeatedly, obviously in different circumstances, but those would still apply in this situation as well. In addition, for annual meetings, a significant amount of planning and logistical work goes into the decisions that are affecting it. If a company is considering contingencies around its alternative meeting timing or place or location, at the time that it files its proxy statement, it should consider providing disclosure of those considerations and provide investors with a roadmap to understand that if a decision is made to change the time or the date or the manner in which the annual meeting will be conducted, how that information will be disclosed. And as a general matter, we would expect that to be disclosed via a press release and or Form 8K that would be filed with the SEC in either case as supplemental soliciting materials. I'm now going to turn the discussion over to my colleague, Chris Walter, to cover employment considerations.
Thank you very much. And hello, everybody. Today, I want to address a few remarks under each of four headings. First, business continuity and containment actions. Second, collecting and processing of personal data. Third, some employee relations considerations. And finally, contingency planning for a mass outbreak. Certain of the issues raised will inevitably require closer consideration of local law, including contracts and collective bargaining agreements and so on, but we do hope that many and expect that many of the themes underlying my remarks will be common to almost all international employers. So starting with business continuity and containment actions, employers may find themselves in one of two difficult positions when managing their workforce currently. Either employers want to require or allow employees to work from home, or conversely, they may want to require reluctant employees to come into the office. Each of these positions raise interesting questions as employers try to balance health and safety obligations with business continuity. It is becoming the norm for employers to implement voluntary self-quarantine regimes, permitting employees to work from home if they find themselves in certain risk categories. Mandatory quarantines are commonly required for those who have traveled to at-risk areas or have otherwise been exposed to the virus. And we expect a growing number of businesses may close their physical offices entirely if there is a severe risk of exposure, for example, because an employee is diagnosed. According to a Mercer survey of over 300 companies from 37 countries conducted between February 6th and February 18th this year, 58% of employers have arranged for greater flexibility for employees to work from home. The same amount, 58%, of employers requested voluntary self-quarantine of 14 days for staff that recently traveled to mainland China. Others, around 43%, have instituted a mandatory self-quarantine. We suspect these percentages are significantly higher now, considering how quickly the virus spread since the survey was conducted. When considering whether to allow or require employees to quarantine, obviously you'll want to review your local health and safety obligations and guidelines and be conscious of any indirect discriminatory impact, particularly if older workers are at risk or if special travel measures might be required, for example, triggering national origin concerns. You'll also want to consider the organization's policy regarding company-provided or government-required sick leave and the pay implications of a quarantine. In many jurisdictions, sick leave is available to take care of family members too, not only the employee's own sickness. As infection rates increase, it may be useful to look at how employers based in China have handled office closures. According to a Willis Towers Watson survey of 158 national and multinational employers, most work sites in China have closed, and 82% of employees in China are being directed to work from home. Most furloughed employees in China and other locations in Asia are being paid in full, and we understand nearly all employers in Asia will continue to pay employee benefits, even if the work site is closed. On the other hand, you might want to require employees to continue business as usual, when they might be reluctant to commute or to expose themselves to others. Generally, employees must comply with reasonable and lawful requests, but to what extent are employers able to insist on attendance at work in a fast-moving situation in which formal guidance may lag behind events? Might they risk breaching local health and safety rules or damaging trust or confidence? What financial or other compromises might be necessary or appropriate to avoid legal risk? Many, many employers are, of course, taking recommended practical precautions, including disinfection and increased monitoring of common areas, making reasonable inquiries of visitors, e.g. to exclude those who might have returned from a high-incidence country within the last 2 weeks, and provision of helplines and access to guidance. According to Willis Towers Watson, 30% of companies are screening visitors and employees currently. Check also if you're under any local legal obligation to provide protective clothing and face masks to employees. You might also check for any local incentives in the fight against COVID-19, as some governments, for example China and Singapore, have announced financial support measures for business, such as tax and social security cuts, payment facilities, subsidies for no redundancies, and so on. It is commonplace for employers to monitor or control travel, including personal travel. Consider what to do with employees who travel a great deal and what is proportionate in light of current guidance. The Willis Towers Watson survey I mentioned, which was conducted mid last month, reveals that nearly 2 in 3 employers have cancelled planned trips to select countries for their North American employees who travel internationally for business. 55% are encouraging virtual meetings to decrease travel. The survey also shows that almost half of respondents have conducted research to determine which employees are at risk of COVID-19 based on their travel patterns. Next, just a few remarks with respect to collecting and using information about employers. Employers are asking us whether they are allowed to request medical checks, take temperatures, or collect other information from employees that might shed light on an employee's exposure risk. Health data constitutes sensitive or special category data for the purposes of the GDPR, as I'm sure you're aware. The collection, storage, and processing of medical data therefore requires that enhanced levels of protection be afforded. Guidance from local data protection authorities is currently limited, In Europe, only DPAs in Italy, France, Denmark, and Poland have so far produced written recommendations. What is there focuses on two questions. First, what can employers reasonably collect from visitors? And two, to what extent can employers share health data internally? Advice with respect to visitors is that it would not yet be proportionate to seek sensitive health data, despite arguable public interest justifications for doing so. However, information relating to recent travel is not sensitive data, and its collection may therefore be more easily justified. According to Willis Towers Watson survey, 30% of employers require screening for visitors currently, and for employees who have recently traveled. As to the sharing of health data internally, there's much less guidance currently. Our view is that some degree of disclosure may be justified on public interest and health and safety grounds, but the care should obviously be taken to balance the privacy rights of individuals against other considerations. If you are permitted under local law to collect personal information, aim first to provide advance notice to employees of any updates to company policy, limit the dissemination of information held about employees with the virus on a strict need-to-know basis, and document processing justifications and suitable steps taken to ensure security of information shared. Finally, on this topic, employee representatives might also need to be informed and consulted with respect to any new policies impacting work practices. Next, just some brief remarks on employee relations. Bear in mind that in a number of jurisdictions, law may entitle employees to flexible work where that is necessary to look after dependents. For those working from home, consider whether you have in place up-to-date health and safety assessments, e.g. with respect to display screens and so on, and remind folks of policies on storage of confidential business-sensitive data, timekeeping policies, etc. Consider whether specific health and safety bodies might also need to be consulted. And another good tip is to evaluate health plan coverage for medical expenses necessary to diagnose or treat the COVID-19, including any out-of-pocket costs to employees for these expenses. Consider whether to offer employees access to providers through a telemedicine network. And finally, contingency planning for a mass outbreak, the worst-case outcome. Unfortunately, many of our clients and friends are having to think about this eventuality, including how to maintain a safe workplace in the event of a mass outbreak, how to contain employment costs and loss of productivity without having to lay off employees. Protective steps might include, obviously, a hiring freeze, management of contingent or agency staff resources, withdrawing offers of employment to candidates or delaying start dates, delaying or freezing salary increases, reducing non-cash benefits, retraining or redeploying staff to unaffected or less affected areas of the business, and offering employees sabbaticals. Again, in countries with stringent employee representation rules, such considerations may be the subject of consultation and even co-determination with employee representatives such as works councils and trade unions. And with that, I'll pass over to my partner, Ben Lenhart, who will speak to some insurance considerations.
Thank you, Chris. This is Ben Lenhart, and I'm going to cover four key issues involving coverage for coronavirus. First issue, what types of insurance policies could apply? Well, the most obvious is event cancellation insurance. If you have scheduled an event and need to cancel or postpone the event due to coronavirus, event cancellation insurance, if you have it, should reimburse the amount you're out of pocket, including extra costs related to refunds, vendor costs, notification costs, other administrative costs, as well as the lost revenue resulting from the cancellation. Now let's turn to other types of policies that may not be quite as obvious. Four other policies that may apply to coronavirus. One, property policies, which cover two main areas. First, physical damage to your own personal or real property, and second, lost profits or lost revenue caused by interruption of your business by coronavirus. We'll take a deeper dive into property insurance in a second. Second type, pollution legal liability. If you have that, it can cover the cost of decontaminating a property because of coronavirus. Third, general liability insurance, which can cover your liability if you're sued because of coronavirus. For example, if someone sues you alleging that you caused or facilitated exposure of the coronavirus to other persons or to other property, then the GL policy should cover both the defense cost to defend such suit and the amount needed to pay any settlement or judgment, subject, of course, to any deductibles. And last, directors and officers or D&O insurance. These cover suits against directors and officers or against the company itself based on alleged corporate actions or omissions related to the coronavirus. For example, a D&O policy should cover the costs to defend and resolve a lawsuit against the company or its directors or officers for failure to properly account for or disclose the impact of coronavirus on your earnings. With any of these policies, early notice of the claim and cooperation with your insurer are essential to maintain coverage, as is the need to carefully track those costs that you want to include in your insurance claim. Second, turning to property coverage and taking a little deeper dive. Property coverage is the focus for the rest of the talk because that's the coverage that's most likely to cover the largest corona-related losses. These losses can include, number one, the cost to clean up contaminated factories, buildings, or other premises, or contaminated parts, supplies, or other materials and render them safe for use. And two, it can cover lost revenue or lost profits resulting from plant shutdowns or disruptions, or customer or supply chain shutdowns or disruptions. This latter coverage is known as business interruption coverage, and we are seeing coronavirus-related business interruption claims in significant numbers over the last few weeks. These business interruption claims can arise in several ways. First, a coronavirus-related shutdown or disruption of your own plant or facility. Second, a coronavirus-related shutdown or disruption of your supplier's plant, thus causing supply chain problems to your own business. Or third, a coronavirus-related shutdown or disruption of your customer's facilities that negatively affects your business. And these are just a few examples. The coronavirus-related shutdowns or disruptions can arise in a number of ways. For example, there can be a quarantine or stay-at-home order from a government entity based on coronavirus. There can be a blockage of ingress or egress to or from a plant or facility due to the presence or risk of coronavirus. Or third, a decision by the company itself or the company's suppliers or customers to shut down a plant for coronavirus-related reasons. Third, we'll now take a look at the two of the most important coverage issues related to property damage coverage for coronavirus. And these two are the requirement of physical damage and the so-called contamination exclusion. First, physical damage. Many, but not all, of the coverages in a property damage policy require a showing of physical damage related to some property or loss at issue. This physical damage requirement may be satisfied in a number of ways, but one avenue may be to show that coronavirus is present in a plant, such as on the walls, floors, doors, railings, materials, foodstuffs, supplies, clothing, or on other surfaces. The science in this area is unsettled, but some reports state that coronavirus can persist on surfaces for many days or even weeks. And remember that the physical damage need not be to your own property, but the coverage may also be available if the damage is to property of your suppliers or customers or even to nearby locations. Now turning to the contamination exclusion. This exclusion, which seeks to exclude coverage for losses arising from certain pollutants or contaminants, is present in some but not all property policies. There are several good reasons why the contamination exclusion may not apply to coronavirus-related losses. Number one, some policies don't have the exclusion. Number two, some policies that do have the exclusion fail to define contamination or pollutant, and in the absence of a definition, the courts will generally narrowly construe the exclusion and may find that it does not extend to coronavirus. Third, some policies apply the contamination exclusion to some but not all of the coverage grants. For example, it may apply to basic property damage, but it may not apply to ingress, egress, or civil authority coverages. You have to read the policy carefully to see which grants of coverage are subject to contamination exclusion. And then fourth, some policies have a critically important exception to the contamination exclusion if the loss or damage is otherwise covered by the policy. That is, if some other part of the policy covers coronavirus-related damages, then the contamination exclusion, while it still applies generally, may not apply to coronavirus. And this brings me to my final topic, my fourth and final topic, which is coverage for communicable diseases. Some properties include a specific grant of coverage for communicable disease. Communicable diseases are often defined in the policy to include losses arising from diseases that are transmissible from human to human, which likely includes coronavirus, or almost certainly does. The communicable disease coverage often includes all of the costs related to cleaning up a facility contaminated by coronavirus, as well as the cost of disposing of any contaminated materials, and may even include any PR costs related to reputational issues arising from the coronavirus crisis. More importantly, if a policy contains a communicable disease coverage grant, this may limit or negate the impact of the contamination exclusion, at least in the context of coronavirus. Thus, lost profits or supply chain interruptions caused by coronavirus may not be subject to the contamination exclusion if the policy expressly covers coronavirus under a communicable disease grant of coverage or otherwise covers coronavirus. In addition, while some policies may have sublimits for communicable disease coverage, these sublimits may not apply where a communicable disease, such as coronavirus, leads to other losses arising in other parts of the policy, such as lost revenue, lost profits, or losses from supply chain disruptions. These coverages may not be subject to sublimits, or if they are subject to sublimits, they typically have much higher sublimits. So to wrap up, the bottom line on coverage for coronavirus is this. Coronavirus coverage may be available under property policies and a variety of other insurance policies. We have already reviewed many corporate policies for coronavirus coverage, and whether or not you have coverage for your specific coronavirus losses will depend largely on the precise wording in your policy along with the relevant case law applicable to your claim. We stand ready to help you on these issues. I'll now turn it over to my colleagues, Tricia Anderson and Dan Feldman, to cover policy considerations, starting with Tricia.
Great. Thank you so much, Ben. I will touch briefly on three topics that intersect with U.S. national policy. First, I'm going to give an overview of U.S. quarantine and other emergency authorities that, as my colleagues have indicated, have the ability to impact U.S.-based workforces or supply chains. Second, I'll talk about the authorities of public health agencies to request disclosure of personal information, such as to enable contact tracing. And finally, I'll talk about a few of the cybersecurity implications of the coronavirus crisis and some best practices that companies might employ. So first, turning to quarantine and other federal emergency authorities, obviously we've already seen broad exercises of quarantine authorities globally, most notably in China and Italy to date. As I'll discuss in more detail, the authority of the U.S. government to regulate entry into the United States is more robust than its authority to restrict movement within the United States. So at the national level, we're not likely to see the kind of drastic exercises of internal quarantine authority that have been exercised elsewhere. But the potential impact of quarantines in the United States is still quite significant. So let me dive into some of the specifics. Here in the U.S., federal, state, and local governments possess a range of authorities that are available to confront communicable diseases like the coronavirus. The key authority that federal, state, and local governments can exercise to combat health emergencies is the quarantine power. And there are two main types of quarantine authority. The first that I'll talk about is external quarantine authority, which refers to the ability of a jurisdiction to prevent entry into the country or restrict travel across states. The second is internal quarantine power, which refers to the ability to restrict movement within a jurisdiction such as a state. And I'm using the word quarantine here as a shorthand, but these authorities generally include other powers, such as the ability to require isolation of persons who are ill or to require mandatory testing or other data collection. The federal quarantine power comes from the Public Health Service Act, which authorizes the Secretary of Health and Human Services to take measures to prevent the entry and spread of communicable diseases from foreign countries into the United States and between states. And that authority has been delegated to the CDC. The exercise of these authorities requires identification of a communicable disease as qualifying for federal quarantine authority, and that power is already unlocked for COVID-19 under a 2014 executive order that added severe acute respiratory syndromes to the list of communicable diseases eligible for quarantine. So the potential for the exercise of this authority is already in place. In terms of external quarantine authority, the CDC has broad power to deploy border controls to prevent the spread of infectious disease and may quarantine anyone entering the country from a foreign country that it has reason to believe is infected or has been exposed to a communicable disease. So the person need not be exhibiting signs of symptoms of illness. This authority can be used with respect to people, but also what the statute refers to as carriers, which could include an airplane, ship, or other method of transport. And it's already been exercised in a very limited instance with respect to the coronavirus outbreak. It was used to quarantine the initial number of U.S. citizens who were brought back from Wuhan, China, in the early days of the outbreak. As I mentioned, internal quarantine authority within the United States is much narrower. CDC regulations authorize the quarantine of a person only if that person is reasonably believed to be in a qualifying state, meaning that they are actually infected and are at a communicable stage of the infection. There must also be reason to believe that the person is about to cross state lines or might infect others who are moving across state lines in order to tie it to the federal power. But beyond this federal power, state and local authorities also have quarantine powers and are largely responsible for managing public health threats within their own borders. State laws generally require an individual assessment that a person poses a risk, as well as a scientific basis for quarantine, and that the quarantine must be achieved through the least restrictive alternative to achieve public safety, a standard that seems likely to be met in this circumstance. States largely provide broad authority for implementing involuntary quarantines. In California, for example, only probable cause or reason to believe that a person is infected with a communicable disease is required for a health official to institute a quarantine order. To the extent quarantine orders are issued, they typically impose harsh penalties for violations. So, for example, a person can be criminally prosecuted for violating a quarantine order. At the same time, the opportunity for judicial review of an order is likely to be very limited, and threshold doctrines like standing could preclude third parties, such as employers, from challenging orders that are not directed specifically at them. And although we've seen courts extending slightly less deference to the U.S. government in certain areas, it is unlikely that courts would second-guess the underpinnings of a quarantine order in these circumstances. Beyond quarantine authorities, there are other federal emergency powers that could be brought to bear on the coronavirus situation. So, for example, the president could declare a major disaster or emergency under the Stafford Act, which would unlock an array of federal assistance to state and local governments. And there's some news reporting this morning that this is being considered by the White House. A declaration under the Stafford Act would allow the president to deploy FEMA and to provide funding and personnel to combat the virus. For example, FEMA could provide medical assistance teams, medical hospitals, and military transport. And the Stafford Act has been used to combat circumstances of other outbreaks of viruses, such as outbreaks of the West Nile virus in New York and New Jersey in 2000. There are other national security-related authorities that could be brought to bear on combating the virus. So, for example, the Defense Production Act of 1950 gives the president broad authorities to influence domestic industry in the interest of, quote, national defense, which is defined broadly to include emergency preparedness activities. In the context of the coronavirus, HHS Secretary Azar has said that the president could invoke the act to expedite certain contracts, including for supplies such as face masks, gowns, and gloves. In a webinar that we're planning for Friday that will focus on the life sciences industry, we'll take a deeper dive into this possibility then. The Project BioShield Act could also be used to fund countermeasures. For example, it's been used in the past to fund countermeasures for other viruses, such as to add vaccines for Ebola to the strategic national stockpile. And finally, the president could also declare the coronavirus outbreak a national emergency under the National Emergencies Act or under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which could activate other emergency powers, and that's been done in the past, as President Obama did with respect to the H1N1 pandemic. So turning now to the authority of public health agencies to gather information from the private sector, public health agencies typically have broad authority to gather information that could be relevant to their efforts to contain or mitigate infectious diseases, such as to enable them to conduct contact tracing of an infected person. and companies that possess information about a person's contacts may receive such requests. And indeed, we're already seeing clients that are facing requests of this kind. Typically, these authorities do not overcome other statutory restrictions on disclosure of data. How a company should respond to such requests will depend on whether it is subject to particularized restrictions on data sharing, as well as the sensitivity level of the data requested. So, for example, requests for customer contact information may be inherently less sensitive than information about their precise travel pattern or protected health information, and you may have greater latitude to disclose near contact information. To the extent you are providing personal information of one of your users or customers to a public health agency or of your employees, you can mitigate legal risk by providing by requesting documentation of the request by the public health agency that cites the agency's authority for demanding the relevant form of information. But if you're in a heavily regulated industry or if the public health authority is requesting the kind of data that implicates a statutory protection, you may wish to consult legal counsel before responding. So finally, I'm turning to my third category of policy issues, which is cybersecurity considerations. And we've seen the spread of the coronavirus already beginning to cause a shift to increased reliance on teleworking and remote access to protected company networks and data. And this trend seems only likely to increase over the coming days. Companies should be prepared to provide secure connections for their workforce and to maintain good cybersecurity practices with respect to those connections. For example, systems should be updated and fully patched, and multi-factor authentication should be in place. These capabilities, along with continuity of operation plans, should be tested over the coming days to the extent your business is not already making broad reliance on them. At the same time, the virus can provide increased opportunities for cyber criminals, and we have seen time and time again that cyber criminals are opportunistic and prey upon human vulnerabilities through social engineering. There have already been instances of specific coronavirus-related phishing schemes. So to the extent you haven't already done so, now would be a good time to remind your workforce about such scams and the need to verify the source of emails before clicking on any suspicious links or attachments. Now I'll turn it over to my colleague Dan to address further policy and crisis management considerations.
Thanks. So I'll build on Tricia's information about federal authorities and national security, highlighting other policy implications of coronavirus at a state and local level, at a federal policy level, and global policy repercussions. And then in closing, just offer a few comments on crisis management and mitigation before turning to a few questions and answers. First, as you're well aware from news stories and the prior speakers, the precedent we've seen of coronavirus in other countries is one of massive disruption. Less than 3 weeks ago, Italy reported just 121 cases. Yesterday, authorities put travel restrictions on the entire country, affecting 60 million people. We'll see if the U.S. ultimately implements quarantines and social distancing strategies, but with potentially millions of Americans infected, there will be mass disruptions, including closed workplaces and schools. As a result, multinationals will need to take this into account as it will place unprecedented stress on your companies and executives and impact all typical corporate functions. This outbreak could also last longer than a typical crisis, so prepare for the long haul, things like planning for regulatory deadlines that may be missed. Officials at state, local, and federal levels will be making key decisions that truly impact your companies and employees' lives. And as a result, you need to do your best to bolster your corporate crisis management backbone in vital areas like government relations, human resources, and information technology. We work closely with clients on scenario planning exercises where companies deal with a host of variables as we strategize to mitigate risk and business disruption. At a state and local level, you'll see that state and local authorities will exercise significant powers during this crisis. Several states have already declared states of emergency, including California, Florida, Maryland, Washington, and New York. And these state powers include the ability to bypass typical bureaucratic prerequisites, including in hiring additional personnel and procuring certain materials and supplies. One of the staples of our public policy practice is providing state regulatory and legislative strategic advice and guidance, where we serve as a nerve center in coordinating a range of initiatives in three key categories. First, in advisory services and scoping, things like developing advocacy strategies, analyzing and comparing bill languages across states, calibrating responses, drafting legislative language, providing strategic guidance and advice, and creating leave-behinds and messaging materials. Second, the actual project management. So in particular, monitoring state-by-state developments, organizing progress calls and overseeing benchmarking, managing and leading coalitions to advocate in key states, coordinating with trade associations, and vetting and retaining local lobbyists who can act as boots on the ground for you. And third, in the direct lobbying, including facilitating meeting, meetings with local elected administrative officials and staff in preparing and delivering testimony and related advocacy materials. Second, there's a broad spectrum of rapidly evolving federal responses, which our policy team is closely tracking and proactively engaged on. So in addition to the $8.3 billion emergency package passed by Congress last week, yesterday the White House announced proposed economic policy solutions in response to the effects of business on businesses and workers due to COVID-19, including President Trump's suggestion that he meet with congressional leaders today to discuss a payroll tax cut and legislation to protect hourly wage earners, as well as exploring expanding loans by Small Business Administration and looking at programs of the EPA and other related agencies. As countries develop their own responses, some will provide creative policy proposals for the U.S. Japan's covering the wages of parents who stay at home to care for children or sick relatives. Singapore is trying to protect the gig economy with helping cab drivers and others, and we'll see what evolves in the U.S. at the federal level. And lastly, given the global nature of this outbreak, the global impacts are significant, not just the widespread impact in countries hard hit in China, South Korea, Japan, Italy, and Iran, but over 80 countries have now issued trade restrictions. Countries have issued export bans on medical protective equipment and other medical supplies, and obviously a range of industries are particularly hard hit. The airline industry, shipping industry, and supply chain disruptions are particularly impacting the electronics sector. Our China team, based in Beijing, Shanghai, and Washington, maintains relationships with senior officials across the governments in both countries and is well positioned to provide insights and help clients resolve and mitigate problems arising from the coronavirus outbreak and its impact on operations and in business with China. Companies in China have been evaluating their strategies, footprint, and supply chains in the region as the reset in China's relationship with the U.S. unfolds. The coronavirus will provide further impetus for this strategic rethink at many companies. And we're helping clients undertake this process by assessing potential scenarios, identifying particular risks and opportunities for each scenario, and facilitating the development of strategies to mitigate risks and capture emergent opportunities. Our Brussels office is closely engaged in the work of the EU, including the EU debate today on containing coronaviruses. The EU announced just last week that it would give governments all the fiscal leeway they needed to deal with the economic impacts of coronavirus. And the crisis in Europe is likely still on the upward trajectory as already weakened Eurozone economies sink further. And in addition to sovereign issues, there's the role of multilaterals and international financial institutions, which is quite significant, not just the public health organizations like WHO, but the announcement by the World Bank of $12 billion and the IMF of $50 billion last week available for addressing COVID. And lastly, I want to add a few words about crisis mitigation and management as we frequently work with companies in the midst of such crises. First of all, we strongly encourage all companies, if you haven't already done so, to develop a crisis management playbook, a carefully prepared, embedded approach for a crisis that includes things like activation guidelines and a communications plan and materials. As the case in any crisis, companies should ensure they have an effective chain of command, and developing a communications plan and materials are critical that they be pre-vetted and improved, including things like putting out a holding, formulating in advance a holding statement, a first response statement, talking points, social media action plans, and including directions to staff on who's authorized and how to interact with the press and other stakeholder calls. We also suggest developing comprehensive contact lists and action plans, which can include checklists with assigned owners for completion, templates for legally required notifications, legal guidance on issues like document retention directives, process directives, and other logistical considerations. And in my experience, the most common issues that lawyers confront in managing a crisis are a lack of coordination and direction, discussions about document preservation, privilege issues, public disclosure obligations, and interacting with insurers and auditors. We also frequently serve as chief strategists in coordinating roles of outside consultants, which includes hiring outside communicators or government relations consultants to help preserve privilege. So as Doug said at the outset, if there are any questions on this or any other concerns, please don't hesitate to contact us and we'll identify the right person to respond to you. But during the course of this call, we solicited questions from all of you, and we'll take just a few minutes to answer select questions that came in. So the first question, which I'd like to address to Chris, is that certain training and conference companies are continuing with courses. These are global courses with global attendees. So how should businesses deal with staff members enrolled for these courses, as the risk is obviously high, and especially attendees from, in this instance, Africa or elsewhere, going to the UK or the US to attend courses?
Thanks, Dan. I think it's reasonable to be concerned about this, and we are seeing a number of these events being cancelled or plans being changed, particularly since, you know, travel restrictions seem increasingly likely in certain countries. So there's a problem, or risk rather, that your employees might go to the conference and be unable to get home. So I'm not aware of any direct guidance in many countries on this specific issue, but I would have thought that a cautious approach makes sense, and hopefully organizers themselves are thinking about these issues and able to provide either VTC alternatives or dial-in facilities. It may be that instead of sending a group of people, employers would prefer maybe to send one willing participant who could share materials among those who would otherwise have gone. But this one, I think, is about the employer's own risk tolerance and obviously, you know, the location of the organization and so on.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Two more quick questions, and then we'll wrap it up within the hour. So for Ben, we've heard that insurance coverage is not available for coronavirus because there's no physical damage to any property. Is that correct?
Right. So that is not correct. There are several types of policies that expressly don't require property damage. I mentioned those, but event cancellation is the most obvious, where it's not required. Or so often not required. Directors and officers claims don't require property damage. General liability does not require property damage, and in fact expressly covers liability for bodily injury. And then even for property policies, which often do require physical damage, and I talked about that, in fact, with coronavirus, you may well have physical damage. Contamination on surfaces may well constitute physical damage. And the other key point there is to remember that the property damage need not be to your property. If there's coronavirus-contaminated property of a supplier or of a customer or of a nearby location, that physical damage can constitute property damage insuring coverage for your loss.
Thanks. And lastly, for Nigel, if I need to cancel an event, when should I make the decision and what are the risks?
You certainly should be careful about the timing. Cancellation without valid grounds may constitute a breach of contract or trigger liquidated damages. Government guidances and orders are obviously changing rapidly, so the position can change almost day by day. So I think being careful about the choice of timing and when you take an action. But I do recommend that you communicate with the counterparty to explore what compromises can be reached, and that can be done actually in parallel with decisions around sending a notice.
Thank you. And thanks to all of you for joining today's briefing. In the next few days, we will be circulating a checklist of the issues we have outlined here today. In addition to today's call, our life sciences team is hosting a briefing call on issues specific to life sciences companies on Friday, March 13th. If you do not receive an invitation by email, you can register through our COVID-19 toolkit on cov.com. The toolkit is a repository of our resources on these issues where you can navigate through various event invitations and recordings, advisories, blog posts, and other content. Please note that the information provided on this call does not and is not intended to constitute legal advice, but please feel free to reach out to me or to us directly or to any of our speakers today, and we will work together to assist you. Thanks once again, and please stay safe.